Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out by Gold Medal Squared.
Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen.
Today, we're thrilled to welcome to the show two-time Olympic silver medalist and mindset coach for Compete to Create, Nicole Davis. Nicole, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm fired up.
We are too. So we want to start out getting right into it, talking about self-talk. So first, can you tell us a little bit about what your self-talk was like as a player?
Ooh, can we cuss on this show?
For sure.
Let it rip.
Let's hear it.
No, I think, for so long, my model is a little bit broken. And so the way that I understood how to get good was to incessantly work. And a lot of that incessant working was driven by pretty unproductive self-talk. What's challenging about self-talk, which is where confidence comes from, is that things like self-critique or the lens of perfectionism will get you good sometimes. You know, the thought that, like, you idiot, that's not good enough, or I'm just not there yet, for example, will sometimes push you to do the extra rep or go a little bit harder. However, often that's born out of an anxious mind that if you don't, that things aren't going to work out in the future. And it's kind of, you know, as a mentor of mine, Dr. Mike, talks about, it's the do more to be more model rather than learning to have epic self-talk that supports you just showing up and being your most authentic self and having, you know, volleyball in my case, but whatever your craft is, just have that be an expression. And so my self-talk was often steeped in frustration, in self-critique, a little bit of self-doubt, and sometimes pessimism, especially down the stretch when, you know, I wasn't sure if I was going to make an Olympic team or roster or something like that. And as I said, some of that drove me to do more reps. But, you know, if you're programming your mind to look for what's wrong, then inherently that's suboptimal for sustainable performance. And it's the antithesis of finding joy and challenge and difficult experiences. And so what took place for me is that all of that negative or unproductive self-talk, in my opinion, kept me from really maximizing my potential. You know, like I was one of the best in the world, but I feel like I left some on the table because I couldn't figure out how to be a world-class coach to myself.
Was that something that you were able to work through as a player, like towards the end of your career, or was it, do you feel like you were in the dark the whole time?
That's a wonderful question. I was a two-time Olympian already before I learned that you could formally train your mind. So the way that I understood confidence until that point, until after my second Olympics, was that it came from my work that I did, and that if I didn't feel confident, I could rely on some sort of technical cue to help get me back. And that's not entirely wrong, but what I started to understand was that the more consequences I felt were on the line, the less weight that held for me in terms of generating confidence. So I didn't understand the mechanics of confidence until our team and our staff started working with Dr. Mike Gervais. And really, that was the last 3 years of my career, which were the most difficult because I had a string of concussions to start the quad that really changed a lot for me.
Yeah, wow. That's pretty cool. I'm excited to keep learning from you about confidence and self-talk. But I would love to hear, you know, hindsight is 2020, looking back on your career. Do you think that, like, how different would your experience have been if you had been working on this at an earlier point? You know, are you stoked about the journey that you had and wouldn't change a thing, or, you know, how do you feel about it?
Yeah, that's a challenging question. You know, I think the thing that resonates most with me is that there wasn't a lot of joy in the process for me. And some of that in the beginning was it was a difficult culture to be a part of. So I didn't feel connected to everybody or supported by everybody. Some of it was that just every day is hard, especially at that level, you know, when you're trying to squeeze out growth and learning and while performing and there being high expectations. But I do think that had I trained my mind earlier, even if performance wouldn't have been any different, I think I would have found more joy in the experience. And yeah, that's important because I think the model that we see often in our culture, at least, is that the two are dichotomous. You're a high performer, and the rest of your life is completely screwed up, you know, or you're miserable, or you're really happy, but like you're sitting the bench or something. You know what I mean? Like, it's like we don't see these examples of people who are thriving on and off the court, so to speak, readily in the media or in our culture. And finally, high profile athletes are starting to talk about to speak out about mental health, which I think is changing the paradigm. But I think just the nature of my experience would have been different. I do think, and I'm biased in saying this, I do think my performance would have been more consistent at a high level had I started training my mind earlier. But you know, there's no way for me to
can I ask you two different questions on that?
Yeah,
like, so first one, do you think that joy and fun are the same thing? Like, I hear a lot of players saying that I want to have fun.
Don't think they're the same. Joy is something that is, so happiness is fleeting. Joy is a more sustainable, positive, emotion.
Yeah.
And it feels different. Like, I think fun is more akin to happiness. Like, I can have fun for the next 5 minutes, you know, but it doesn't light me up in the same way that a moment of joy would. Right. And I think we can experience happiness, but not be fully present and engaged in what we're doing. I think it's really difficult to experience joy without being fully present and fully engaged in what you're doing.
Yeah. To me, like, in my mind, I think of happiness as, or like fun as like eating ice cream, and joy is like grinding through something that's really hard and then coming out and, you know, making it through. But love hearing what you're saying about that.
But it's also like when you're in it and it's difficult, like having that familiar grin on your face when it's really good to be you also, because like there's a deep understanding that something good is on the other side of all of the grinding out, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it's maybe more rare to experience joy, but I think it's possible. You know,
yeah.
I'm working towards helping people find that because I do believe it's possible.
Well, so looking back on your career, you know you better than anyone. If you could kind of bundle it up nicely and give yourself some teaching or coaching about self-talk, like what would you say? Just, you know, you got like 30 seconds to just talk to Nicole Davis in, let's say, 2002, whatever.
You can have more than 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Thanks. I appreciate that, guys. Yeah, it's really, really gracious.
Yeah, anytime.
I think... one thing I would say, I've said this already, but like, I was not a world-class coach to myself, and I was mistaken in that, like the way that I talked to myself was a driving factor for me. And so I thought, well, it's okay, 'cause I'm getting better. And I didn't understand that, like, it was getting in the way of me being my best. So be a world-class coach to yourself. To do that, you have to learn how to talk to yourself as if you would your best friend in a time of need. And because there's a lot on the line every single day. And if you fundamentally design yourself, your life around growth, which is what I was doing, then inherent in that process is some really difficult feedback and the absence of reinforcement often. And so you have to be able to generate some type of reinforcement and be clear on what you're working towards and why. And self-critique and doubt and frustration, all that stuff, it really gets in the way of being able to filter through that process.
Can you give an example of that? Like some of the reinforcement example?
Yeah. So just if we follow like theories on human learning and like behaviorism, for example, if let's say okay, let's say a little kid, right? We teach little kids not to touch the hot stove, and they still want to explore, right? Because they have a beginner's mind and there's such a curiosity for the world. And then finally, when they don't do it, if you say, okay, that's good, honey, then they're not that likely to do it again. But inevitably, curiosity will get the better of them, and they'll touch the hot stove. And that pain that they feel on their hand is an aversive stimuli. And so they won't touch the hot stove again because it was so painful. The same can be said for like positive reinforcement. You know, like if a dog rolls over, you give it a bone, then they start to learn the command roll over because they get a bone afterwards. That's positive reinforcement. As athletes, it's kind of the same. It's like a dog getting a bone. You know, when the coach says, good job, Nicole, when you make the right angle, that's positive reinforcement. The higher the level you go up in a sport, the less often that's always going to be there. And if you've really designed your life around growth, then there's going to be a lot of failure in the process, which is a negative reinforcement. And so to be able to stay in it when there's negative reinforcement or a lack of positive reinforcement is really challenging. It's counter to human learning. And I think it's what makes the difference between, you know, Olympic athletes or elite performers and those that really can't make it in that environment is their ability to stay in it in the absence of that and to just still design their life around growth. So, you know, I might be playing my best and feel, and this happened at World Championships in 2007, and then not get a starting nod as a Libro, which feels like everything's over because there's only one person that gets to go to the Olympics in my position, you know? And so that is an example of a lack of positive reinforcement. I feel intrinsically that I'm doing my best, but yet I'm still not getting what I want. And so what's hard about volleyball and team sports is that you could be the best in the world and the coach still has a decision that will impact your life. And that uncertainty is anxiety provoking for most people. And so once you get to that space, it's really hard to stay in it.
Can you take us through your self-talk now? I know you do public speaking, you're a teacher, you're a leader. Mm-hmm. Has it improved? I'm guessing it has. And what's that process mm-hmm. been like?
Yeah, I've done a lot of work, which started at the last 3 years of my career. But even since then, I've done a lot of work on understanding my self-talk and really like exposing the patterns of thoughts and beliefs that were getting in the way of me being my best and having the best experiences I possibly could. And so, you know, what my self-talk used to look like, and it still does sometimes, right? Because confidence is contextual, but when it's unproductive, it usually falls into the theme of I'm not good enough. And what I've worked hard to be able to reframe that to is either I do difficult things, so I can do difficult things now, or I can adjust. And those two statements have enabled me to show up in lots of environments where I'm not quite sure if I'm prepared enough. And I'm not quite sure if I have the skill to meet the demands of the environment, but there's credibility in that. Like I get uncomfortable every single day, so I can say to myself, I do difficult things. And I create space for myself to no longer feel like I'm overly prepared so that I can test myself, so that I can say I can adjust, right? I can't say those two things to myself if I don't work in a purposeful way to be able to back it up or build credibility for it. So my self-talk now, when I need to generate confidence, especially in nuanced situation, usually revolves around those two statements. I can do difficult things, or I can adjust to whatever comes my way.
Love it. And then, so with all the athletes you've worked with, as a mindset coach, are there some common forms that you've come across? Like, I don't know if you're able to, is clean enough to put people into like categories, but would you say there are some, I don't know, some common ones that you've seen?
Yeah, some of it revolves around like pessimism, which is like there's an inherent belief that things aren't going to work out in the future, you know, like, and a lot of this comes down to outcomes. Outcomes matter in sport as they do in all aspects of life, but we can't control them. And so what takes place is they become a distraction. So pessimism, or the thought, like the theme that things aren't going to work out in the future is one of those buckets. Self-doubt is another bucket, like not knowing if I'm good enough or I have enough skill. You know, in volleyball, that's like oh crap, I'm getting served. Under that is like an inherent belief like that I don't have enough to do this right now. I can't side out, for example. Frustration is another bucket or theme, which is, you know, like, why do I keep making the same mistake, for example, especially with people who are a little bit, you know, self-critical or perfectionistic, not allowing oneself grace in the process of learning. What else? Self-critique, like you're an effing idiot, you know, like those sorts of things, like the most horrendous things that you would probably not ever say to anyone else because they would be hurtful. We tend to say to ourselves sometimes. So those are common themes that I see in terms of unproductive self-talk. And then if we look at themes around more productive self-talk, it would be something around the lines of optimism, which is like there's a belief that something good is about to work out. And you can observe this in athletes or teams that play really well point by point, regardless of what's taking place in the score. Another aspect or theme around productive self-talk that generates confidence is what we would call like a swag statement, but like we all have this like statement in our mind when it's really good to be us. For me, when I was at the height of my career, it was like, not today, bitch. Like there's like nothing that you can do right now that is, that is going to get past me, you know, like we all have that like swaggy statement in our head that helps generate confidence. Most people don't take the time to like identify what it is though, so that they have that reference point or that compass to come back to. Just being locked in the present moment is also another way to generate confidence. You know, it's hard to access all the training you've done when you're in the past thinking about what just went wrong, or in the future thinking about what could go wrong. Past success is also another theme or bucket that that helps generate confidence, you know. And this isn't like the accolades or the achievements that you have. This comes back to that idea, like I said, I do difficult things, you know, so I can do difficult things now. And then it's like, well, what are those difficult things? And so when you're in a moment of test, if you can go back to like that body of work, that can help generate confidence as well. And then technical cues do help. But like I said before, you know, like early arms or set the angle or lead with your hands, whatever it is, like anecdotally in my own experience, when I tried to rely on technical cues and I couldn't get locked in the present moment, just be where my feet are. I wasn't sure what that swag statement was. It was harder for me to generate confidence in moments of real consequence or perceived consequence, I should say.
Nicole, thanks for going through, you know, the buckets that you kind of worked through. Okay. So let's say like our most pessimistic player, it's probably not going to go over very well for me to be like, well, look, you just got to be a little more optimistic. Things are probably going to work out.
Nope.
Like realistically, how as coaches do we help out with someone who is either really pessimistic, experiencing a ton of self-doubt, a lot of frustration, a lot of self-critique? Because I think this is really where the magic is. Like we can talk about technical cues all day, but if this is all, you know, the bedrock of what's going on in their game, then, and we haven't addressed it, then we're probably not going to get nearly as close as where to where we want to be as we'd like.
Yeah. I'll give you two kind of examples or options of how this could work. What helps in individual training, like when I'm walking someone through how to train self-talk, the first is to identify the unproductive thought, right? And then the second is called logical reanalysis. Essentially, like, is this working for me, or is this 100% a fact? And 99% of the time, the things that we say to ourselves is not a fact, and or it's just not working for us. It's not helping us generate confidence. So one of the things that you can say to someone who's like it outwardly expressing pessimism or negative self-talk is, hey, like, I hear you and I know it's challenging right now, but is this working for you right now? And if it's not, then like, what do we go to? Like, how can I help you get to some place that like, or some thoughts that are going to work for you right now? I would go with that. Just creating space for someone to like level set with themselves. Like, I'm I'm in a bad place right now, you know, like, and it doesn't have to be this way. If we go bigger and we look at how culture and language in, impact mindset, the language we use as coaches is really important, because that then becomes the language that athletes use with themselves. And so, you know, does the language that we use as coaches, or is the language that we use as coaches, is it supporting a love of challenge, for example? Is it supporting a growth mindset? Is it supporting vulnerability? Or do we always talk about outcomes and execution? Because if we always talk about outcomes and execution, then by nature, the athletes that we're coaching will start to become anxious about outcomes and execution, because outcomes and executions are not in our control. So I always want to use language that supports an athlete doing and saying things that are 100% in his or her control, because it's when we are uncommonly consistent about focusing on the things that are in our control that we have a sense of groundedness, that we can positively affect things in the future, whether that's our behavior, outcomes, whatever, knowing that, like, it's not always going to work out. We can influence it, but it's not always going to work out. Does that make sense? So being really careful about the language that we use around outcomes versus process, around being a person's best versus comparing ourselves to others, will impact a person's mindset and the way that they talk to themselves. So you have a way to impact from two levels: the language you use when you're coaching, but also like helping individuals become more aware of whether their mindset or their self-talk is actually working for them in a moment, and creating space for them to reframe it to something that's more productive. There's a difference between productive and positive, and I'm using that word really, really specifically. Like, it doesn't have to be fluffy, you know, like, it could be a really difficult moment. It's okay to be like, hey, this is really difficult and this shit sucks, but like, thinking that things aren't going to work out in the future, it's not going to help you. So like, what might help you right now? You know, like, how about just like this one ball? How do I get you to just like be where your feet are and feel your feet in the sand? That would be a way to get someone out of, like, help some guide someone through that process. Mm-hmm. Versus like, hey, you're really pessimistic right now. Like, I don't really know what to do. You know, yeah. Like, that sucks to be you, you know? So
you're right.
it's like telling someone to be calm when they're losing their shit, it usually doesn't help.
Yeah. Can we keep going through them? Like, self-doubt, like, what's, you know, are we still going through the logical analysis that you were talking about?
Yeah. So it's really like, there's two questions around it. You know, if you have self-doubt, like, I'm not good enough, then the question is that working for me? No, it's not, because it's not helping me generate confidence. If it's like, I'm not prepared, for example, and then there is a seed of doubt of whether, like, that's true or not, you know, like, wait a second, I was sick all last week and like, I didn't get to go to practice. So right. I really don't feel prepared right now. So then the question is like, is that 100% a fact, or is it working for you? Either way, right?
Yeah.
It's not 100% a fact, even though it might feel like it's a fact, because you've been playing volleyball for what, 12 years, you know?
Right.
So what's under that, you know? And if it's not a fact, even if it's like, yeah, I'm not prepared. Okay. What are other times in your life where you've not been prepared and you've been able to show up, you know? Like, we do that all the time. All of us have walked into situations where someone's shotgunned, like, hey, by the way, you got to present in 5 minutes or whatever it is. Or hey, coach is like, hey, you're going in. You're like, what? Like, you know? And so we've all had moments of unpreparedness where we've been able to show up to lean on that, you know? So there's such a, like, a nuance to the tone that we use with ourselves. Like, I'm not prepared, this sucks, versus like, I'm not prepared, this is fun, like, what can I learn from this moment, you know? Like, so that's why I say productive, because it doesn't have to be positive, it doesn't have to be fluffy to generate confidence. It just needs to work for the individual, and that's going to be unique to each and every person, what works for them.
Yeah. And you,
does that help or make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess, you know, there are so many more buckets, but, you know, talking about frustration and self-critique too, would probably go through that same process, which is really helpful, because then you're challenging the athlete to think through it too. You're not just offering up some little nibble for them to, you know, right. like it's some panacea that's going to cure all right. their doubts, so, like, and fears.
Like, with frustration, like, I'll straight up ask, like, are you frustrated? And the answer is usually yes. And it's like, great, that means you care. That's awesome. Like, if you didn't care, I wouldn't want you to be here, you know? And so it's like a diffusing, just like an acknowledgement, like of the space that the person is in and correctly labeling the emotion that they feel. But then as a coach, what you can understand is usually what's underneath frustration, because a secondary emotion is fear that something's not going to work out. So then you can have that conversation, you know, like, you know, like, what would you like this experience to be like? Which is the opposite of focusing on an experience not working out.
Mm. Yeah. Self-critique, anything there?
Yeah, that's tough. Because I think it really drills deep down into a lack of self-acceptance and self-compassion. And there's likely reasons why a person is deeply self-critical that go back to relationships with parents and youth sport coaches and peers, and I think it goes really deep. And so in my journey of understanding my self-critique and being able to let go of it, mindfulness meditation was really important for me, because I would hold on and attach to the self-critique and not really understand like where it was coming from and why it wasn't productive for me. And so through mindfulness meditation, just like being curious about how I experienced the moment and being able to like enhance my capacity for attention. And then when I became distracted, understanding what distracts me and then letting go of it without judgment, that process of like letting go without judgment, has been helpful for me in recognizing self-critique and kind of just like smiling at it rather than buying into it. So self-critique usually calls up a lot of other emotions, and then we usually attach and buy into it. There's a difference between the emotions we experience and feeling like we are those emotions. And so through the process of mindfulness meditation, practicing that, and then also specifically practicing self-acceptance and self-compassion, I've been able to let go of a lot of self-critique. And so I usually suggest a mindfulness practice for most of the clients that I work with in the performance space.
I've heard you say that, you know, when you have some negative thought or something, that you wink at it. And I love that, that image and that phrase. It's so good.
Yeah. I love it as well. Yeah. There's lots of ways to do it. I think I got that from Dr. Mike. But you could say hello and goodbye to it. You could just kind of smile at it and like, just like acknowledge, like, I see you mind doing that thing that you do, but like, I don't have to buy into this right now. You could just like gently note it, like self-critique, and then come back to a different focus. There's lots of strategies around it, but for me in particular, I think just like bringing some levity when it's like not good to be you, like Courtney Thompson is a great example. Like when things are going hard, like are really difficult for her, she's just like, God, I'm in it right now. Like I'm so in it. But it causes laughter, and laughter is great medicine, you know, like it calms the nerves. The actual like aspect of breathing out calms the nerves, but it's nice just like get yourself out of that space and have more of a balanced perspective on what you're going through rather than an attachment to it being good or bad.
Well, thanks for taking us through all those, and we'll move on into perfectionism. But before we do that, could you just give, say, coaches one big rock they could do each day with their teams to help with self-talk?
Well, first, I think you have to explain that confidence comes from self-talk, and that we have the opportunity to train our self-talk. I think we don't teach confidence in the United States. Most people, if you ask them where it came from, they'd say belief in oneself or experience or preparation, and all of those are fallible. And so first, like, can you teach your kids that they can, that confidence comes from self-talk, and you can actually train it, would be the starting point, and then walking them through what is productive self-talk and what is unproductive, and helping them generate some awareness around it. So I would say start there to drive awareness. Second is be really particular about the language you use when you're giving feedback to your athletes, so that it essentially is the self-talk you want them to have with themselves. And again, there's a difference between productive and positive. And so you can still be critical, but have a tone that is that facilitates a growth mindset, for example. That would be my big rock.
That's so good. And you know, John, I know you've looked a lot at Dr. Wolf's research on optimal learning theory, and talking about how, you know, setting positive expectations, or what's the language that she uses?
Enhanced expectations.
Yeah, I mean, I think that ties into self-talk. If, you know, if a coach is there with you and saying, hey, you can do this, you can do that next rep a little bit better on this one, then that is hopefully, is that the kind of feedback loop that you're talking about too, Nicole?
Yeah, definitely finding what went well, and then also like identifying what could be even better. So like if we just get to like a strengths-based model of coaching, like are you looking for strengths in the athletes that you're coaching? Are you looking for what's wrong constantly?
Right.
And so you can coach up people's strengths. Sometimes we need to fine tune, like if there's a glaring hole in someone's skill set, yeah. We do need to get to that. But like what often takes place is coaches are so narrowly focused on what's not good enough rather than enhancing strengths that someone already has. And usually what takes place is when you do that, then the thing that's not good enough will correct itself.
Ooh, so, do you have a like balance of that? I'm sure there's no exact number, but how often, like catching them doing it right versus like, you know, let's upgrade or do this better?
I don't have a number for you. Give us a ratio. I would say like, I would say, like 75% of the time, I'd be looking for strengths and what's going mm-hmm. right. And again, like there's a difference between what could be even better and what's wrong. Like it's very nuanced, but there is a difference. Mm-hmm. And you can hear this if you ask kids these two questions after, let's say they're in hitting lines with a block, right? And after they hit, when they come back, if you say, hey, what went well in that? Even if it's the most epic mistake they've ever made, right? What went well? And it's like, I got my elbow back. Okay, great. What could be even better? They'll say, I hit it out. Like, that's not what the question was. That's what went wrong. What could be even better? Well, I had good contact on the ball. I could follow through a little bit better in the direction that I want to hit. So just that nuance in how we're analyzing our athletes, or how we're helping them analyze themselves, is more productive for performance than the hyper-focus and training the brain to look for what's wrong.
Thank you for listening to Coach Your Brains Out, presented by Gold Medal Squared. Join us next week for part two with Nicole Davis on perfectionism. And if you haven't done so already, check out Coach Your Brains Out, the book, available at Amazon.com.